When the writer Justin Martin read Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass as a high school student, he never imagined that years later, that iconic poetry book would be an essential part of his research for his fifth book, Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman and America's First Bohemians.
I read Leaves of Grass as just a reader. I mean, of course, I had my yellow highlighter there to highlight things that I wanted to quote later, but I loved it, and that made it all the more pleasant to be able to tell this narrative story.
Justin Martin shares details about Whitman's early years with a coterie of other artists in Pfaff's Saloon, and how Leaves of Grass was saved from obscurity by Henry Clapp, the editor of the influential Saturday Press, a publication Martin dubs as sort of a malevolent New Yorker. Hear about Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman and America's First Bohemians, today on New Letters on the Air, produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. I greet you at the beginning of a great career. That's what Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote to Walt Whitman in 1855 after the first edition release of the 12 untitled poems in Leaves of Grass. But this groundbreaking work of American free verse that grew to 383 poems by Whitman's death in 1892 has always had mixed reviews. So when I sat down with Justin Martin after the fall 2014 release of his book Rebel Souls, I wanted to know if he had always been a fan.
You know, it was assigned to me in high school. It was homework. I read whatever minimal amount of it I needed to in order to attend to that. I didn't like it. It didn't excite me. It didn't move me. And in fact, when I pitched this proposal to my editor, one of the things I dreaded was I thought I was really pitching Whitman, the grand 19th century personality. And I was nervous about how I would feel. This time it was going to be a new homework assignment for research for my book. I thought, well, that's the thing I was kind of not relishing. This time, when I started reading Leaves of Grass, I was just blown away by it. And I think it also helped to be older. It also helped to have it animated by Whitman the person, which was what I was studying. And then to see the interplay between him and his poetry made it come alive for me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Rebel Souls, because Walt Whitman is such an American figure in poetry. I know you've written about Ralph Nader, you've written about Greenspan, Frederick Olmsted, the great American landscape architect. And I would imagine with these books, you're spending years with them doing your research. So what was it about this period of Whitman's time that made you want to pursue this?
What really drew me to it was there's actually never been a book on Pfaff's Saloon where Whitman hung out with this group of bohemians back in the 1850s. And even a typical Whitman biography would devote maybe a couple pages or a couple paragraphs to a four-year period in his life. And what really drew me to it was this is the flesh and blood Whitman. This is not the Whitman, you know, sort of up in the ether, dining on ambrosia with Homer and Dante. This is the real Whitman who hung out in a saloon. It was a part of the saloon was set aside for gay men, so he was meeting his fellow gay men. And this experience, the experience of being in a saloon in a group of artists where there were fellow gay men, was essential to his poetry. And so that was what I was drawn to the project for, because I'm always interested in the real person, not the mythical figure that sometimes comes after.
You know, for a long time, people didn't even want to talk about the fact that Whitman was gay. Taking English classes in the 70s, it wasn't anything that was taught in class, but there were like whispers about, you know, he was really gay, you know, but that was never in our textbook.
It's very true, and it's essential to his identity as a poet. He wrote many poems on themes of male romance. He also was the great poet of America, the great poet of diversity, the great poet of union, all those things that, you know, one would want to really appreciate him, particularly in modern times, in the times we're living in now. You want to appreciate him for the person he really was, and the person he really was informed his poetry.
I wanted to have you read a little bit from Whitman at the Crossroads, and this sets up who he is early on and how he ends up at Pfaff's. When all of this was happening, it was in the 1850s, before the Civil War had broken out, though that is definitely on everybody's mind. But Whitman had already written his first edition of Leaves of Grass, and it didn't really sell that many books. I mean, he was a little defeated by it. And it was during this time that he added all those other poems to it.
What you're describing, too, is what really drew me to the book was this was Whitman adrift. And this is something that every artist, every person goes through. It's really relatable to have a time when one is lost. Born in 1819, Whitman grew up living mostly in Brooklyn. His father was a speculative home builder with abysmal business instincts, and his family was forever skating on the brink of ruin. By age 11, Whitman was done with formal schooling and went to work to help his large family, which includes seven other siblings. Whitman worked as an office boy for a law firm, then for a doctor. He found intermittent work out on Long Island as a country school teacher. This was one of the many places in those days that had no official certification and required only the most minimal qualifications for teachers. He tended to classrooms as large as 80 kids, some older than he, for a rock-bottom salary. He also tried his hand at selling pencils and inkstands out of a small Brooklyn storefront. But his primary occupation was journalism. At age 12, he got his first newspaper job as an apprentice at the Long Island Patriot. Over the next quarter century, in an era when the profession was remarkably unstable and unremunerative, he worked for a wild array of publications in Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Long Island, the Daily Plebeian, Evening Tattler, Statesman, New World, and New York Mirror, to name just a few. He did every possible job, from operating a bed and platen hand press to writing articles. At age 22, he landed his first editorship with a big city daily, taking charge of the Aurora, a Manhattan paper that competed, not very effectively, with about 20 others. He even founded a couple of newspapers, including the Long Islander. For this paper, he wrote most of the articles and sold all the advertisements, often trading ad space for potatoes or firewood. He delivered the paper himself, traveling the 30-mile route once a week on a horse named Nina. Whitman wrote about everything. He covered a baseball game between New York and Brooklyn, separate cities in those days. He reviewed Umo, an early novel by Herman Melville, an exact contemporary, though the two never met. He tried his hand at medical advice, and quotes, "to cure a toothache, plunge your feet into cold water." At one paper, he wrote a regular column on murders in New York City. Another, he produced profiles of city characters like coopers and butchers. He wrote editorials against capital punishment, in favor of stricter rules on ferry boats, and against dueling, which he denounced as honorable nonsense. The papers where he worked often received complimentary passes to various entertainments. Even as a young apprentice, Whitman got to use those tickets. On rare occasions, he was able to get someone else to join him, often one of his brothers. There was a set apartness to Whitman from early on. For all the people he met, he would always lack for intimates. But viewing performances alone had its advantages. It allowed him complete focus. He gained a thorough knowledge of Shakespeare, developed a particular passion for opera. When Whitman went to see Contralto Marietta Alboni, he was utterly transfixed, even though he didn't speak a word of Italian. She did something like 40 performances during her New York stand. Whitman caught them all. Over the years, Whitman spent enough time in Manhattan to become the ultimate Broadway rambler. Small wonder that he eventually found his way to Pfaff's. He grew to know the two-mile stretch from City Hall to Union Square probably better than anyone ever. He had his own peculiar collection of spots he enjoyed visiting. There was Dr. Abbott's Museum of Egyptian Antiquities, where he passed untold hours looking at mummies and artifacts. There were several daguerreotype studios on Broadway, including one run by the celebrated Matthew Brady. Creating daguerreotypes was a new process, and getting one's picture taken was a novelty, sweeping the nation. Whitman regularly made the rounds, studying the portraits. At the Broadway Temple, meanwhile, Whitman attended learned lectures on a huge array of subjects. He was exposed to the latest thinking on geology and astronomy, which held that the Earth was very old and space unfathomably large. Broadway was an infinity unto itself. Whitman loved the street for its bizarre contrasts and unexpected harmonies. Here it was possible to attend a play about pirates and also to meet a coach driver named One-Eyed Joe. Owing partly to his own humble roots, Whitman felt a rapport with the coach drivers and other working men. He would greet the drivers who constantly traversed Broadway with a kind of downward salute, like a chop. They invariably returned his greeting. When Whitman took a coach, he liked to ride up front, sitting beside the driver. He didn't necessarily talk much on the ride. He was always sparing with spoken words, more content to listen. But in the company of drivers, he felt an ease, while among his fellow artists, he would be forever wary. Over time, Whitman developed his sartorial style in emulation, pretentious imitation, some of his contemporaries would argue, of such working men. He even compiled a dictionary full of slang such as bender, bummer, spree, and shindig, picked up from coach drivers and blacksmiths and stevedores. Though never published, Whitman's Primer of Words was intended as an update to Noah Webster's landmark work. A sample entry for so long, then still a slang term, goes as follows. a delicious American New York idiomatic phrase at parting. At times, Whitman would simply stand on Broadway, studying his reflection in a shop window and marveling at how his image blended with the multitudes passing behind him. To Whitman, the result was a highly satisfying optical illusion. Manhattan was coursing through him.
That's Justin Martin. His newest book is called Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman and America's First Bohemians. Manhattan was coursing through him. You know, what I love about that is it not only sets up the scene and who he was, but how he gets entranced by the language of the common man, which I think shows up in his work.
Very much. I always think about the fact that Walt Whitman, his contemporary, was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and you've got Walt Whitman. I mean, he was a casual, colloquial, interested in America and its breadth and its grandeur. And of course, at the time when the first and second editions of Leaves of Grass were published in the 1850s, it was really radical to have slang. I mean, today people are used to, you know, seeing slang work its way into high art, as it were. But to include slang terms in poetry was just jarring, astounding. It's one of the things that many of his reviewers that gave him bad reviews for those earliest editions, they took issue with the presence of slang in what was supposed to be high-flowing work.
You know, we have to say that Walt Whitman isn't the only character in here, because you have his whole coterie of people, and it's really Clapp who brought the idea of the bohemian way of life from Paris and brought it to New York City. He himself was from Nantucket and raised by a very religious family. All of the story I did not know, so it was a wonderful exploration. Let's talk some about the other important people that were in Whitman's early days.
Sure. Well, Henry Clapp, editor of the Saturday Press, he convened the circle of people after coming back from Paris and being exposed to Parisian-style bohemian. I think of him almost like he curated this group of people. And so people would come to this long table in Pfaff's basement saloon that seated about 30 people, and you'd have to sort of live by your wits. If you were a sharp enough wit, Clapp would let you stay, and the fellow bohemians would let you stay. Otherwise, you'd get kind of run off with various jibes and barbs and so forth. And it was just an incredible group of people that he pulled together. And I also thought of him as sort of almost like being a chemist. He wanted to get the right chemistry of different people in different artistic pursuits and arrange them along that table. So you had Whitman, the poet, of course, but you also had Artemus Ward, who was America's first stand-up comic. You had Fitzhugh Ludlow, who wrote one of the best-selling books of 1857 called The Hashish Eater, detailing his experiences with the drug. At Clapp's long table, you also had quite a number of women who were regulars, including Ada Clare, who was known as the Queen of Bohemia. She'd usually sit at Clapp's elbow, and extremely witty essayist who was very
And he was kind of in love with her.
She was delighted to be part of the circle, and he wanted more out of the association. And Ada Clare, she was very ahead of her time in her essays. I loved reading them. They were on topics like constricting women's fashions of the day, such as hoop skirts, and how this was designed to keep women in a kind of servile attitude. And she also, when she went to Pfaff's saloon, she'd have to find childcare. And she wrote a wonderful essay about the challenges of working women to find childcare.
We should say here that she was a single mother and never married.
That is right. And she was very forward. When she introduced herself in public, she would say that she was Ada Clare, and this was her son, and it's just the two of us. There's no man in the picture here, and she was very bold and comfortable in that role.
You know what I also really appreciate that you do in here is that you've gathered some photographs, so we actually get to see these characters, too, through these photographs, which is really nice. Was it hard to get permission to use the photographs?
It was a challenge, because this is the first book I've done. It's a group biography, and so the research was widely dispersed, and the photographs were widely dispersed, and so it was tough to find where these things were resident and also who ultimately held the rights to them. So yeah, it was a challenge.
Talk a little bit about the process of beginning this book, Rebel Souls, the steps you took.
Sure. Well, the steps were the usual steps of drawing up a proposal. And so the proposal is important to sort of to figure out hundreds of people passed through Pfaff's saloon and hundreds of people earned a seat on one night or another at that long table. So one of my big challenges at the outset was I thought, I don't want to write a book and nobody wants to read a book with hundreds of ill-developed characters. So I almost thought of a tiered system. Whitman's the big name, the grand American figure that people remember. So I thought he should be the central character. And then there are what you might call secondary and tertiary characters who I wanted to pick the right people who interacted with one another in interesting ways and who were a variety. I mean, everybody from Ada Isaacs making the colorful naked lady actress to Artemis Ward, America's First Comic. You wanted them to be varied in their pursuits and their interests. And so that was really my challenge at the outset as I was doing my proposal, was to figure out the right small number of people to really focus on. And then I call it filigree around the edges. I'd mention many of the other hundreds of people who passed through the bar, but without going into a lot of detail. So picking my main characters, picking them carefully, and figuring out the narrative arc of the story.
Well, I love the setting of this bar, Pfaff's. And I thought I would get you to read a description that begins chapter 2 of your book.
Oh,
you actually talk about it some in the foreword, but I like the way you brought it to life in chapter 2. It's very short, but it'll give people a picture of where we're talking about.
On moving to New York, Clapp was able to settle in remarkably quickly. This felt like a spiritual home, as surely as Paris had before. New York's vastness, jumble, and most of all, its veil of anonymity made the city a welcome departure from the confining Puritan world of his early years. Clapp managed to get piecemeal work as a journalist and also did some translation, French to English. As he settled into the life of the city, Clapp held fast to his idea of bringing Bohemia to America. In 1856, he happened upon a promising venue for this experiment, Pfaff's Restaurant and Lager Beer Saloon. For Clapp's earliest visits, the establishment may have been located elsewhere on Broadway, but it soon settled into its famous spot in the basement at number 647, a few doors north of Bleecker Street. Pfaff's was situated beneath the fashionable Coleman House, but the saloon had almost no relationship with the hotel above. No stairway descended from the lobby. Instead, it was necessary to find a street entrance marked by the word Pfaff, faintly lettered on the hotel's gray brick exterior. The full name, Lager Beer Saloon, etc., appeared only in newspaper advertisements. Beneath this obscure sign was a hatchway in the Broadway sidewalk. One entered here like going into a root cellar, proceeding down a steep, narrow metal stairway to the saloon. Pfaff's was a surprisingly ample space, extending underground for much of the length of the hotel's lobby above. It was also very modestly appointed. Sawdust covered the floors, a handful of wooden tables and chairs were scattered about. Above the conversational din, one could hear the distant clatter and neighs from the horse-drawn coaches on Broadway. The low ceiling hung thick with smoke. A small number of gas lights provided the sole illumination, faint and flickering. The play of shadows was extreme, contorting the saloon's customers so that they looked by turns grotesquely squat or wildly elongated. All of these elements contributed to a kind of spectral, otherworldly feeling. The saloon operated Monday through Saturday with an official closing time of 1 a.m., though often patrons were still reveling hard as the sun began to rise over Manhattan's East River. Here, the rules were meant to be broken.
That was just a little bit from Chapter 2 of Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman and America's First Bohemians. You're listening to Justin Martin here on New Letters on the Air. What a great place.
What's fascinating about Pfaff's is you got the room with the long table where the artists meet, but then you have a separate room in the saloon for odds and ends people who didn't fit into 1850s society, including lots of gay men. So Whitman is at Pfaff's Saloon half the time sitting at that long table at a time when he's lost, getting inspiration from his fellow artists, being goaded on to create new art. Half the time he's meeting gay men in the main room of the saloon. And then as he starts to experience really one of the most creative cloudbursts in his entire life and career while he's hanging out fast, he has both the experience of the gay men he's meeting on, the drawing for his poetry, and the support of this fellow group of artists and their inspiration to draw on. So it's just this period of being lost, this period of creating the big definitive edition of Leaves of Grass, what you might call the Pfaff's edition, the 1860 edition. And as you mentioned...
Oh, I love that, the Pfaff's edition.
Yeah, it in many ways is, because it included more than 100 new poems, all of them written while he'd been at Pfaff's Saloon, exploring various controversial themes that were in society at that time, whether it be the United States on the eve of the Civil War hurtling towards disunion, or again, romance between men, a big theme in that third edition. And what happens next is this incredibly, is Henry Clapp, his great champion, and had this malevolent New Yorker as his journal, he then proceeds to publicize Whitman up, down, and sideways in this journal, which was very influential in its day, and he rescues Whitman from obscurity by just touting and touting again and again and again this new edition of Leaves of Grass, running three separate reviews of it, inviting the fellow bohemians at that long table to write appreciations, bits of gossip, parodies of Whitman's poetry. All that had the net effect of taking this work that was starting to sink like a stone, like his earlier editions had, and getting it to, you know, it wasn't going to be a runaway bestseller or anything, but it set him on the slow path to poetic renown and ultimately to poetic immortality. It's a good example of Whitman at his most lost, wandered into the saloon, and that's where he was found in every way.
Yeah. Well, it's intriguing, too, because this was a place that let him be himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think about being a struggling artist, there with so many other struggling artists, the difference is he lived a long time, and a lot of his cohorts from the Pfaff days didn't. I mean, there's some sadness in this book.
It is. It's kind of remarkable because the first French Bohemia, everybody's actually kind of familiar with how people died from tuberculosis, is the cliche, and people can cite the works, you know, La Vida Bohème, you know, tuberculosis. You know. Then the second American Bohemia, lo and behold, almost everybody, with exception of Whitman, dies young, often under tragic circumstances. And I've continued to kind of grapple with why did that happen? And I've come to the conclusion it had to do with intense commitment that all of these people felt to their art. It comes at a price, and the price in their case was, for so many of these artists, they were committed to create art whether society accepted them, whether they were making money at it. They were going to create art no matter what, and it came with a huge price. It meant poverty. It meant that, you know, jangled nerves from rejection and frustration that they calmed with substances. The poverty that they experienced often made them susceptible to illness. So I guess the best way to put it is, with the exception of Whitman, and Whitman paid a price in his own way, but all of these people sort of paid the price of being passionately and intensely committed to art no matter what.
There's one other person that is on the fringe of Pfaff's, who wasn't really part of the inner circle, but we have to talk about him because we're in this part of the world, Mark Twain.
Mark Twain
was a huge fan of Artemus Ward, right?
That is right. That was one of my favorite stories I learned about in researching the book, was how, like so many of these artists, Artemus Ward, when the Civil War broke out, he was forced to travel across the country peddling his act. And while in Virginia City, Nevada, a silver rush town, he met a young comic writer who only a few months earlier had adopted the pen name Mark Twain. So you had Artemus Ward, who was a big star. Abraham Lincoln was a big fan. He was this revolutionary artist who created this stand-up comedy routine. And Artemus Ward, if I remember right, was maybe 28. Mark Twain was just 1 year younger. But Mark Twain, although he just adopted a name, he wasn't yet Mark Twain. He was a cub reporter for a paper in a Silver Rush town. He did a lot of writing about mining incidents and conflicts between miners over claims and things like that. Pretty dry stuff. Every now and then they would allow him to sort of run wild and write a comedic piece. Twain was starting to build a regional reputation, but by no means was he known beyond Silver Rush, Nevada, and parts of California. What often happens when writers get together, Twain and Artemus Ward just went wild in this Silver Rush town, you know, just all kinds of drinking exploits and playing pranks on one another. But then as
love
often,
the scene you have of them jumping from rooftop to rooftop.
Isn't that a great, yeah, what happened was Ward jumped up on the roof of a mining shack, and the mining shacks are very close together. It was after a full night of carousing. And then Twain followed Artemus Ward up onto the roof, and then Ward jumped to the next roof of a miner shack. And, you know, they were intoxicated, 5 a.m. or something, as the sun was rising over the Sierra Nevada range. And so Ward jumps to another roof, Twain jumps to another roof, Ward jumps to another roof, Twain follows him. I thought there was something very telling about that, too, that Ward was in the lead at that point over Twain.
And it's a great metaphor.
As so often happens, too, as Ward got ready to leave after this wild week together in Virginia City, Nevada, Twain said, I have some writing and I'd like to show it, if possible, to some of the powerful editors that you know back east. And Ward promised to pass something along. Well, what did Ward pass along to Henry Clapp, the powerful editor he knew back east? But the story, the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County, it appeared in the Saturday Press. It was Twain's first big national break. It got reprinted all over the country. It was a sensational story. And Mark Twain, who was a cranky character, he was always very grudging about giving credit. Many years later, he would say that the Saturday Press gave it credit for being his first big national break.
So it was the Civil War, basically, that broke these people up. Talk a little bit about Whitman And what took place?
Sure. The way I almost think about it is you had Pfaff Saloon was a subterranean saloon. So I think of it almost like the Civil War broke out. It was like Pandora's box opening up and all these people were loosed out into the world. They had to find their roles in wartime. And this was a really, again, to use a term that didn't exist at the time, these were peaceniks. I mean, these were artists. These were not people that were going to be comfortable joining the cause and in taking up arms. In fact, one of Walt Whitman's friends once said of him in this very context, can you imagine anything more incongruous than Walt Whitman killing someone? I've always thought about that. And so the Pfaff's Bohemians, they had to find a role in wartime. And many of them found their roles as entertainers. I mean, just as today, on the home front, scared parents of soldiers, scared siblings and wives of soldiers, they wanted entertainment, they wanted diversion. And so many of these artists like Ada Isaacs Menken with her Naked Lady Act or Artemis Ward, they certainly were much in demand. A role for a peaceable bohemian artist was certainly entertaining people on the home front, even entertaining the troops. Walt Whitman, he really struggled. He spent an entire year after the outbreak of the Civil War still hanging out at Pfaff Saloon, but he was again lost. He was lost because taste in poetry had shifted and people were writing kind of martial theme, you know, take up the flag, beat the drums types of poems. He tried some of those, but didn't feel right. So he spent a year hanging out at Pfaff's. He described it as a slow, you know, kind of a depression. And he was trying to find his way. And one of the things that when I was doing my research, I was most struck by what a very ethical man Walt Whitman was. And so he wanted to find a really a suitable role in this terrible, terrible conflict. And as many people know, what he ultimately found, what really gave him a sense of meaning and purpose, was to go down to Washington, D.C., and minister to the wounded soldiers in the hospitals. Perfect for Whitman, a peaceful poet, to be helping wounded soldiers.
And a great gift to mankind.
It sure was. I mean, he was so very good at tending to the soldiers. And of course, as a byproduct or a happy accident of that, he wrote some of his finest Civil War poetry about his experiences in the hospitals.
Yeah. It's so interesting because so many of these people were trying to be journalists. I mean, that's how they were trying to make it. And I couldn't help but think of how reminiscent it is of what's going on right now with the decline of the newspapers and then all this online stuff. And what is it going to be and who's going to make it and what's going to last?
That is right. All these new forms allow lots of people to pursue their artistic passions. Now, not necessarily getting paid for it, but boy, there are a lot of people out there doing blogs and doing their own unproduced television show that they put on YouTube. Is this an American renaissance with all these people producing art, or is this a sad time when a lot of really talented, well-educated people are putting stuff out there that's not finding its mark? It's another era that bears some similarity to the 1850s. It's the promise of making it as a journalist or as an artist. Of course, those were many of those people in that Pfaff Saloon were people who are struggling, you know, to make it in New York City and make it in these various professions when it was a brand new era, when more people were drawn to this than could possibly be supported. There's a similarity in the times.
Justin Martin, in 2014, after the release of his literary biography, Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman and America's First Bohemians. May 2019 marks the 200th anniversary of Walt Whitman's birth. DeCapo Press has since published Martin's sixth book, A Fierce Glory, Antietam, the Desperate Battle That Saved Lincoln and Doomed Slavery. For links, visit newletters.org and click on the air. Also explore our magazine and books. If you'd like to make us last in these turbulent times, look for the Support New Letters button in the top right-hand corner to make a tax-deductible donation on newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Our weekly program is available as a free podcast with links on Facebook, Tumblr, or Twitter. Today's show is produced with Elizabeth Albano, Sean Weir, Coy Duggar, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.